My friend Dorothy, who's a source of great wisdom for me, once informed me that as a person got to her age, and perhaps to my own age, she spent a lot of time thinking about the hereafter. As when you walk into a room, stop, look around, and ask, "Now, what did I come in here after?" The Car Talk guys on National Public Radio recently read a list of new words that should be added to the dictionary. One of the words was destinesia, going into a room and forgetting why you're there. Most of us have stories, putting the peanut butter in the freezer and the ice cream in the cupboard, finding our glasses in the cutlery door, finally locating our car keys in the pocket of the jacket we wore yesterday, or in my own case, I have no idea what I did with my wristwatch when I took it off last night. I had to go find another one this morning. I didn't have to buy one. I had one in a drawer. You know, we prepare for those eventualities. And it's not just our own stories. It seems that memory is in the news everywhere these days. News stories, human interest stories, science reports. There are memory experiments with mice running mazes. There's a current movie about Alzheimer's disease. We hear about memory impairment from traumatic brain injury among war veterans. Everywhere, people are talking about remembering or about failing to remember. What is it about memory that makes it so important, that makes it so mysterious, that brings it so much into the news, into scientific research, and into our lives? I think it is because memory, as well as our entire ability to think and reason, is so closely linked to our identity. In some very basic ways, we are what we remember. We define ourselves by the events of our lives, what we have lived through, what we've learned from, how we've been shaped by the past. When we meet a new person, we always want to know not only who they are in the present moment, but who have they been? What have they done? Where did they grow up, go to school? What jobs have they held? What families have they been part of? This information from the past shapes how we see them, our understanding of who they are in the present, and what we might have in common or in difference from them. It's so exciting to meet someone from your hometown or a place you lived for a while, or someone who went to the same schools you did. Last year at a spiritual retreat in Wyoming, I discovered that two of the other people there, a husband and wife, had been students at Michigan State University at the same time I had in the late 1960s. The memories of that time came flooding back. We explored the places and events in our common past, and there was a certain at-homeness to that shared experience. And in some ways, it called back for me who I am and how I've become who I am. This linking of memory to identity is to some extent culturally determined, and it's a Western and modern way of looking at the world. It's very materialist, this construction of identity as an accretion of past experiences. It is our identifiers from specific events and places that define who a person is and how she or he fits into the world. In our culture, identity is like a building that one sets in place, beginning with a foundation in a family history, a birth story and early childhood experiences, and so on up through adolescence and into adulthood, piling on remembered experiences like the blocks in a Lego construction. This stands in sharp contrast to the Buddhist concept of no self. A quote here from a paper written by an American expert in Buddhism. "There is no self. Nothing belongs to a self. For Buddhists, no being has any enduring essence or personality. Everyone, even the Buddha, exists in name only. The name really refers to a mix of elements which arise and vanish from moment to moment, carried along from beginningless time on a turning wheel of lives. Indeed, the first stages of enlightenment are marked by a direct and deep understanding that our sense of I is not what or how we imagine it to be, solid, enduring, inviolable, and autonomous. Rather, it is a habit-formed construction held together by craving, clinging, aversion, and attachment." So in Buddhism, we see the self the unique personal identity as a constantly changing entity arising from moment to moment. I suspect that this way of seeing the self, the no-self, would make all this attention to memory less of a concern. But in our Western way of thinking about ourselves, our memories are critically important. If you doubt that to be so, just imagine a conversation with a new friend in which you ask, "Where did you grow up?" And they respond, "I don't remember." "I don't remember? The place where I first came to know the world? The people who shaped my way of thinking, speaking, acting? Where I learned what to wear, what to eat, how to throw a ball, how to hold a pencil?" It is inconceivable not to have any memory of these and other formative influences, because then how would you know who you were? So what do we see around us these days with memory so much in the news? Well, the baby boomers are getting older, and Americans in general are living longer. So these two things are happening at once. There are more women and men entering their middle years between the ages of 45 and 60, when many of us begin increasingly to experience those times when we get to the grocery store without any idea what was so urgent that we had to pick up, or we arrive at the cleaners without the clothes we had intended to drop off, or we may even find ourselves somewhere we did not intend to be at all, getting our days and our calendars confused beyond all recognition. And at the same time, there are more people living into very old age. When I started working in the community back in the mid-1970s, the old, those who were expected to be in fragile health and in need of major support, were defined as those over 75. Now, people over 75 are hiking the Grand Canyon and running marathons. As people live longer, in spite of the remarkable strength and resilience that many exhibit, there's also a striking increase in the loss of memory and cognitive ability, what used to be called senile dementia. Although there are many forms of dementia, and we often associate it with age, it's important to remember that memory loss is not a natural consequence of aging, but is rather a result of an insidious disease process that chokes off the neuronal connections, impeding cognition and destroying memory. The Alzheimer's Association estimates that over 5 million Americans currently have Alzheimer's disease, and it is the eighth leading cause of death in the U.S. Most of those with the disease are people aged 65 and older, but they also estimate that about 500,000 Americans younger than 65 suffer from early onset Alzheimer's or another dementia. The statistics do increase with age, so Alzheimer's is found in about 2% of people between the ages of 65 and 74, in 19%, nearly one in every five people in the next decade of life between 75 and 84, and in nearly half of those age 85 and older. Every 72 seconds, someone in America develops Alzheimer's disease, and by mid-century, they anticipate that that rate will double. Of course, for many of us, it goes beyond the statistics. When my father was diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease in 1999, I look back at what I wrote at that time, and I wrote about being orphaned. In some ways, I lost my father twice. The first time was when his diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease was confirmed, and I realized the dark road of forgetting on which he was embarked. And I looked sadly ahead to a time when he would no longer know me as his daughter. And then I lost him again in May 2000 when he suddenly died of an unrelated cause, so that we did not have to live through that dark descent into forgetfulness. And for that, I am entirely and eternally grateful, although I miss him every day. My father and I traveled to Arizona together shortly before he died. It was planned as a last trip to an area of the country that he loved, and the last places he and my mother spent together before her own untimely death. During that Arizona trip down memory lane, I remember that there were two types of memory in constant interplay. The painfully lost short-term retention, calling for endless repeating and explaining and constant watchfulness to make sure he did not wander away in confusion. And at the same time, there was my father's incredibly acute long-term memory of people, places, and events before I was even born. He spun out story after story, golden vignettes of his life and the roots of my own. Those days of closeness, when we really danced together on the edge of love and pain and memory, as father and daughter, are among my own most precious memories. So why is Alzheimer's disease so devastating? Most simply, because it robs a person of his or her identity, knowledge of self, recognition of beloved others, memories of all that was most intimately known and prized as the building blocks of a life. Everyone I've known who has suffered through a loved one's struggle with this dread disease speaks of it as an experience of nearly unbearable loss and pain. Not to remember, that is to lose oneself. And to remember, that is to know oneself. To remember. That is what this weekend, this Memorial Day celebration, is all about. As a society, we pause to remember those who have gone before us. Memorial Day was first celebrated in 1868 to honor those from both the Union and Confederate sides who died in the Civil War. It is traditionally commemorated as a day to honor those women and men who have made the ultimate sacrifice in defense of the nation, bringing us together in a community of memory, no matter how we may feel about any particular war or even about war in general. Our memory is part of what makes us a community, our shared past, our shared experiences, our shared values and commitments. And when, as a community, we forget our past, that is the equivalent of a societal Alzheimer's disease, pulling us loose from our foundations and eroding our identity. Sometimes, perhaps, it is far too easy to adopt the Buddhist no-self philosophy in our community and institutional lives. Each succeeding moment is unique in itself, unanchored to what has gone before, with no continuity to the larger flow of historical events of which we are only a small and transient part. This loosening of the bonds of memory can lead to a loss of perspective. We can be beguiled into thinking that what we do in the present moment is of ultimate worth and entirely of our own making, forgetting the giants on whose shoulders we stand, and our own role in creating the foundation for those who will stand in turn on our shoulders, who we have been and what we have built. There's a resource known as institutional memory, the historical record that anchors the identity of our human organizations. As I've worked in various public and private organizations, I've come to recognize that in every human gathering there is a need, and often a person to fill that need, for answers to those questions about what we used to do when. Why was this organization created? What have been the landmark moments in our history? Why do we do things the way we do them? I'm reminded of the turkey tail story that's sometimes told to illustrate the processes of change, tradition, and memory, and forgetting in organizational life. The story goes like this. It has some stereotyped sex roles here, so we'll overlook those. A young bride was making her first Thanksgiving dinner, and her husband watched in fascination as she carefully cut the tail off the turkey before she stuffed it and set it in the baking pan. "Why do you cut off the tail?" he asked. She said, "Well, that's the way I learned to do it from my mother, and that's the way my family has always done it." But then she wondered, so next time she talked to her mother, she asked, "Mom, why do we cut the tail off the turkey?" Her mother responded, "Well, that is how we do it in our family. My mother always did it that way, and that's the way I learned to do it. But I never asked why, so I'll ask your grandmother." The next time she visited her mother, the woman asked, "Mom, why do we cut the tail off the turkey before we roast it?" The grandmother looked at her in some surprise and then responded, "Well, I don't know why you do it, but I always did it because my turkey was too large for my roasting pan and I couldn't afford a larger one." Institutional memory, community memory. Where did our traditions begin? Why do we do things the way we do them? Who have we been in the past and who are we now? What is our identity over time and in the present? Charles Foster, who's a theology professor, makes the claim that our modern congregations have lost our corporate memory, our recollection of the shared history that links us to our faith traditions and the foundation of common experiences within the life of the church. I think some of that loss affects us as Unitarian Universalists. This disconnection can happen at two levels. Personally, when we see ourselves as unique individuals existing outside any connection to community or the common heritage of a people, and then congregationally, when we see our churches as islands, disconnected from any history but our own, and isolated from other congregations that share our commitments and our struggles. Such religious isolation as individuals and as faith communities cuts us off from our roots and tears our identity from its anchor to something larger. As with Alzheimer's, when we forget those who we are related to, those whom we love, we also forget who we are. And when we forget who we are, we're in grave danger of forgetting who we can be. Foster calls for churches to establish intentional programs of education to help us remember who we are, to teach our children about our heritage and our connections. And in order to teach our children, we must learn those lessons ourselves. Who was Miguel Servetus, and what did it mean to stand up for his interpretation of Scripture before the terrors of the Inquisition? Why was Theodore Parker shunned by other ministers in Boston, excluded from intellectual discourse and banned from their pulpits? Who was Unitarian minister James Reeb, and why was he beaten to death by a white mob in Selma? What racial split in our religious movement caused Bill Sinkford to give up on the Unitarian Universalists in the 1960s, only later to return and eventually to move into a leadership position in the UUA? These are all aspects of our history as a people of faith, and they've been important in shaping who we are today. And we forget at our peril. We are a brave people, a doubting, questioning, and challenging people, sometimes an argumentative people. And for all that, we Unitarian Universalists are a loving people, gathering in and making space for faithful doubters and questioners of all stripes, working to create a more open and just society for all. So let us guard against and shake off the deterioration of our lost corporate and congregational memory, reclaim our precious historical heritage, and forge the bonds of solidarity with others of like mind, be they Unitarian Universalists, liberal Christians, Jews, or Muslims, or those of other faith traditions. When we are clear in our memory of those who came before and of the events that have shaped us, we can know who we are, and we will recognize each other as well. Then we will have cured our destinesia. We will know what we have come here for. We will retrieve the peanut butter from the freezer and the ice cream from the cupboard, our glasses from the cutlery drawer, and our keys from the jacket pocket. With an intact memory, we can shape our vision for the future and move forward in confidence, becoming always truly more of ourselves in community, more truly our community and society, and together creating a world that knows itself for what it has been, what it is, and what it can be.